Welcome to the Tech Canuck Podcast. This is episode number 11. Hey, it's podcast season again, and the usual suspects are back. I'm your co-host for the show, James Cogan, joined as usual by Canadian pro blogger, Mr. David Peralti. David, welcome back, my friend.
Yeah, so now that it's getting cold out, we have more time for podcasting again. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, seriously. Everything okay in there in London?
Yeah, it's not too bad. I'm in St. Thomas now. We've moved into our house.
That's right. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. So I'm kind of podcasting out of the basement right now because it's a new subdivision, so there's a lot of construction going on.
Well, you know what? It's been a little while since we've podcasted, so let's not waste any time. Let's get right into our talking points. And we're going to start with Canadians falling in love with social networking. Yes, Canada. Not behind the times. We are falling in love with social networks, just like everybody else around the world. A new study from Ipsos Reid has come out that has basically said that, and I'm going to throw some things out here, that 4 in 10 Canadian adults today have visited an online social network, and 3 in 10 actually have created a profile on a social networking website. And Canadian users are spending, on average right now, about 5.4 hours a week accessing social networks. In addition to that, visitors who visit online social networks are more active in terms of using the internet overall, which we kind of figured. And a blog called Buzz Canuck, a great blog actually, has extrapolated data from this study and has surmised that by 2010, 16 million Canadians are going to be using social networking websites. David, I mean, this is pretty big stuff, isn't it?
Not too surprising, though. I honestly think that Canadians have been in the lead in many different areas online. These numbers are probably a little higher than I would have placed them. Going back to what you said, though, they said 4 in 10 Canadian adults, but if you think about an adult as an 18-year-old, you know, what's 18 years ago now? You know what I mean? So for that age group, for the 18 to 24, let's say, I think you'll notice it'll be a lot higher in concentration if you just took that little segment, because they kind of grew up around this stuff. And as the web has brought us all together, it's, you know, created these social networks. And instead of going to visit our friends, you know, wherever they may live, we can track them, you know, down to the second on Twitter and Facebook and the whole nine yards.
Okay, but maybe the more sort of shocking thing that, if there is a shocking aspect to this study, is that when you put it in the context that basically almost all of these social networking websites didn't exist 4 years ago. So here we have, you know, demographic study saying that, you know, Canadians are spending, you know, over 5 hours a week doing something that really didn't exist 4 years ago. I mean, that's a pretty significant inroad into a whole new activity for Canadians in a very short period of time. Wouldn't you agree?
I don't know about that. I think that it's all about the low barrier to entry. If you go back before these sites, everyone was on, you know, AOL Instant Messenger or, you know, one of the instant messaging clients. And unfortunately, that felt rather limited because you both had to be on at the same time to be able to have that connection and share that information. If you think about it, these social networks being the way they are is kind of a logical step. Just the technology wasn't necessarily there to connect everyone together as efficiently as they can now.
Mm-hmm. How much of this study do you think is being fueled by Facebook?
Probably a lot. They, like most social networks, you know, any of them could probably pay for a study like this because they make so much money off of advertising revenue. It's ridiculous. I know that there are Facebook applications out there now that are talking about, you know, $250,000 in advertising revenue. That's just an application. That's not even actually Facebook itself. So you can imagine what kind of revenue they're pulling in.
Yeah, and I guess also, I mean, you know, it's been talked about that Toronto is, if not the top, it's among the top Facebook cities in the world with a penetration of about 800,000 plus users. That's almost a quarter of the city in Toronto that are using Facebook on a regular basis. I mean, that's pretty staggering. So Facebook obviously fueling the social networking revolution that's going on the web. I guess, you know, another question I kind of have about all this is, you know, Canadians are falling in love with social networks. You know, how many of these social networking websites are actually Canadian? I mean, they're spending so much time on social networking websites, but really this isn't reflective of Canadians. Is that something we should care about or not really?
I think you're missing one of the key reasons that places probably like Toronto and Vancouver are so high up in the rankings of people using these networks. And that's because we're such a melting pot in Canada. You have people coming in from all these different countries trying to reconnect with their family and friends from other countries. So attaching themselves to an international platform like Facebook makes a lot more sense than going to something locally or Canadian, because then they might might not have the connections to their family in China or in Germany or wherever else.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, let's face it, the future of Canada is in immigration because we are not, as Canadians, renewing our population. That's a fact. We, you know, our future growth as from a population-based standpoint is almost entirely reliant on immigration. So as people come in and they get net savvy, if they aren't already, you know, using social networks, like you said, to stay in touch with people, with family that are abroad, is a great way to do that. So yeah, that's a really good point, David, for sure. What about privacy? I guess that's another question I have. Is this a sign that Canadians don't really care about keeping their lives private?
The idea of privacy has definitely changed over the last while. Even just over the last 5 years, the amount of things that we keep hidden inside our own houses. My brother and I have a 4.5-year difference, and we have a totally different line that we draw for privacy or what we consider to be private. You know, these platforms really are going to have to think about that over the next little while. I remember Facebook gave you an option to opt out of being having your profile indexed by Google, but there was a huge backlash when they didn't necessarily block Google from indexing your profile. And a lot of people didn't want their name associated with their religion or whatnot, and they felt like they had to start removing that stuff from their profile rather than letting it be, you know, out there in the big cloud of the internet. You know, when it's on Facebook, you know, you feel like you have that protection, that layer of protection, because you know only your friends can see your full profile.
Interesting stuff. So the bottom line is that obviously Canadians are feeling more and more comfortable about sharing certain aspects of their life and not really, I don't want to say care about privacy, because I think everybody cares about privacy to some degree, but obviously people are willing to share, and that's obviously part of the whole social networking revolution and a big component of it. David, let's jump into talking point number two. Let's get right into this notion of microblogging. You and I touched on this a little bit in our last podcast. We talked about Twitter being, you know, all the rage and the in-crowd using it. You and I, a little cold on Twitter. You know, you tried it. It didn't really stick with you, and I didn't even go there in the first place. But now word comes out that Google has bought a microblogging platform called Jaiku, which is, I guess, Twitter competitor along with Pounce. David, what are your thoughts on this purchase by Google? Google getting into microblogging. Are you surprised by this? And are you surprised by this attention that's being placed on microblogging?
First off, I just want to say that I've now tried all of the ridiculous microblogging tools. So I've tried Twitter, I've tried Pounce, and I've tried Jaiku or however you say it.
Right.
And none of them have impressed me. This will appeal to people that don't necessarily want a full blogger account to write their whole life story. They just want to keep their friends up to date. I would love to see how much it took to buy this microblogging platform, just because it would affirm for me whether or not we're kind of in that bubble phase that a lot of people keep referring to.
Right.
You know, if Google paid tens of millions even for this platform, I would be raising an eyebrow or two.
Now, the one point I'm going to make about that, though, is that Google, you know, the one thing you can't really accuse Google of is buying things and then not really having an idea of what they want to do with it. You can accuse eBay of that. There's no question about that. They bought Skype. They had no idea what they're doing with it, and they wrote it off as a loss. They bought StumbleUpon, and we're still trying to figure out what they're going to do with that. Google is a bit of a different animal. When they buy things, they tend to have a use for it, and sort of that leads me into my next question, which is this microblogging thing more about the mobile web than it is actually about, you know, the web itself? Is this a mobile play for Google and everybody else in this microblogging game?
I couldn't agree more. When I first saw this, my question to myself was, why would Google do this? And instantly you started seeing on every blog that mentioned this, it totally makes sense with their future plans.
Mm-hmm.
They know the UK and the US now with their iPhone are really connected to the internet through their mobile devices, through their phones, through their internet-connected devices. And, you know, Google wants to be there. They want to be there with all their products. They want to make sure that they're able to put their ads next to it. And, you know, it's funny because Jaiku is one of the only, you know, microblogging platform that already have Google AdSense ads on it, so it's not really going to be much of a change there. But definitely, this is all about the mobile web. This is all about getting into niches that they haven't been in before. But going back to what you said before, you know, Google does sometimes take a long time to show what their plans are with a product that they purchased.
Yes.
And as soon as they bought Jaiku, they closed down new signups.
Mm.
So, you know, are they kind of shooting themselves in the foot here by not keeping it open and keeping it growing? I don't know. Like, these things are so fad-based that if they don't have this influx of new people adding new content, will people leave? You know, so...
I guess that opens up the door for Twitter and Pounce to capitalize on that to some degree, wouldn't you think?
Definitely. And they probably will. You know, Kevin Rose is a smart guy. He's not going to let this whole thing sit idly by while he doesn't get any press out of it. So.
And, you know, we talked about Twitter initially, and, you know, one of the takes on it from you was, you know, they needed to do certain things. They needed to add certain features. And I guess when this news broke that Google bought Jaiku, you know, some people wondered why they didn't buy Twitter instead. And, of course, there's that synergy with the ownership because Twitter, one of the founders of Twitter is Evan Williams, who was also a blogger.com co-founder from Pirate Labs. So, you know, why didn't Google go after Twitter? Any thoughts on that?
I think the first would be, you know, features. Jaiku has better features than Twitter. It's been up more often, has more positive spin and positive press towards it. And the second big thing is probably cost. Twitter has so much VC money poured into it now that it would just take too much of Google's money to buy it out. They would have been better off building their own or buying, you know, Jaiku or Pounce or another service.
So the fact that they closed off new signups almost indicates that it was more of a technology play than it was a community play.
Oh, definitely, because Twitter has a much larger community. And while Pounce might have more features, it's not necessarily as robust as Jaiku probably is. So.
Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff. No doubt, I mean, you know, while you and I aren't big into the microblogging thing, obviously there are a lot of people who are. And, you know, chances are we're going to be hearing a lot more in this space as time goes on. One last thing. I mean, did Google essentially leave Twitter for Yahoo or Microsoft at this point? Is that sort of where we expect Twitter to go?
I don't really see either of those picking up Twitter, again, for some of the same reasons that Google didn't, but even more so now that Google bought Jaiku. You know, you would expect them to want to compete over Twitter even more now, but I think it's going to be actually the opposite. They would rather position themselves probably for another niche market that Google isn't necessarily interested in, or building up their own brand name. Twitter would fit probably better with Yahoo just because of Yahoo's purchases of, you know, pretty much anything that has the word Web 2.0 after it.
Right.
I really don't see it happening anytime soon.
Is there a business model in this? I mean, has anybody come out with a way to make money off of this microblogging thing, or not yet?
You know what? I really don't know yet. You know, like I said, Jaiku has the Google AdSense, but who knows how much revenue they make because most of their users are probably pretty web savvy and can avoid those advertisements like the plague. So.
Mm-hmm. So I guess when you talk about microblogging and the Twitter stream and all that stuff, you're really, if you're talking about ads, you're talking about very short little text ads, I guess, that would go into Twitter messages, no?
Yeah, you'd probably do it much the same that Facebook does. And what Facebook does is in your daily news feed of all the things that are happening with your friends, every once in a while they throw in a sponsored link to either a product or a service or something along that line. So it actually looks like your normal news feed, and then there's this link, you know, from Facebook itself, and if you click on it, it brings you to, you know, whatever, and if you buy it, they make money off of it. Probably do the same kind of monetization, kind of tricking that Facebook does and kind of get those links in there.
So microblogging and the mobile web, which is a really good segue into our next talking point, which is, and I don't know, maybe we should just call this the Google show or the Google episode, but the Google phone, the G phone. Apparently that's coming. It's definitely on the way. A lot of people, when rumors came out that Google was going to make a phone of some kind, a lot of people thought, oh, this is to compete with Apple. This is going to go after the iPhone. But as more and more stuff has come out about this, it's looking less and less like an iPhone competitor. Am I right about that, David?
I still think it looks fairly iPhone competition kind of thing. I like some of the things. Let's just say I like the changes that they've made to move away from the iPhone because it appeals more to my geeky side.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the Linux-based operating system type thing?
And the news that it's going to be, you know, fairly extendable and not be locked down so you can throw a whole bunch of crazy applications on there, and that it's going to support a whole bunch of different software, and that they're talking to HTC, who is well known at making interesting phones with interesting features. So it'll be interesting. Google doesn't do anything unless they know they can do it well. But I think a lot of people have what they want in the iPhone. I don't know yet how amazing the G phone or whatever they're going to call it is going to be. What do you think about the whole thing? Do you think it's going to be, the biggest product launch of the year type thing when they finally release it? Or?
Yeah, you know, I don't really know what to think about it just yet. I have a hard time imagining Google being in a hardware business. So, no, really, I do. And I just don't think that's a really good fit for Google. So I really have to believe that I think this Google Phone is going to be more about the platform, about the sort of suite of stuff that they have in the phone and then what people can add to it, what developers can add to it. I really look at it more as a platform. And I could be wrong about that. Maybe they're really going to, you know, get into the handset game. But I don't see that as a really good fit. And of course, it is interesting to note that one of the big Google executives is sitting on the board of directors at Apple. So I don't think Google views the G Phone as an iPhone competitor. I think there's more to it, and I don't think it's all about the hardware and the handset. Maybe that's the better way to view it. Maybe this is more of a competitor to Windows Mobile. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can understand that. But Google has learned really quickly that putting their products on a cell phone, like the iPhone, actually works really well for them. It gives them really good market penetration and really good branding. And I totally agree with you. This is a platform. But you also have to remember, you know, Google does do hardware sales. They sell their servers across the world, and they do a very good job at it. They do a very good job at hosting all kinds of complex applications for people, including all their own applications. So
yeah, but David, I mean, dealing with corporations is a lot different than dealing with very fickle consumers. I mean, let's face it, you know, you're talking about brand conscious, you know, what have you done for me lately type consumers that'll move around, and what's hot, what's now, you know, how sexy is this thing? I mean, I just don't see Google playing in that kind of an environment. That's not really a good fit for Google. So that's why I wonder if this phone at the end of the day is really about competing with Windows Mobile and their operating system than it is about the handset itself. I could be wrong about that, but that's just my gut feeling is that this is not an iPhone competitor. But time will tell on that. We'll have to see. Do you have an idea on when this thing's going to come out?
Never. No, I wouldn't be surprised if it turned out to be vaporware, honestly. It seems like the more I hear about it, the more that gets promised. And just like the iPhone buzz, some of those things, just unless they've been locking away some really great hardware people, it's not going to happen. So I would take a gander at 2010, any sooner than that. And
I've heard rumors that this thing could be coming out as early as the first half of 2008.
Then it won't work the way that they've been touting it on all these different articles. It just won't.
You're too soon.
Yeah, too soon. They have too many other things that they have to put in place. You know, their recent acquisitions kind of show that as well, you know, like this Jaiku purchase and other things. They really have to get a lot of applications that could be used really well on a mobile device to really, you know, bring people to it. And from what I'm seeing, you know, they haven't really worked too hard on that. Their best thing would be, you know, Google Maps and then their instant messaging service. But they still have a long way to go before they're the place to go, so...
Interesting. All right. Well, you know, I promise this is our last talking point on Google, but we do have another talking point to talk about, which is Google has recently announced that they are getting serious about video advertising. And in specific, they are trying to derive profit off of their $1.65 billion purchase of YouTube by including contextual ads into YouTube videos, which publishers can then embed on their website. And Google's going to share profits with those publishers. David, what do you think of this? What do you think of Google, you know, getting serious about video advertising?
I really hate animated graphic, number one. Like, so we'll just break it down to that. I don't like animated advertising, or, you know, those banners that like shake all over the place and tell you to click here to get your software upgraded for your virus scanner. I hate those advertisements. And to me, this just seems like the worst version of that, because none of the advertisements that I'm going to see in video necessarily, even the banners above the video, are really going to be, you know, amazing or make me want to click them or be as interesting or easy to remember as, you know, some of the high cost commercials that we see on TV every day. If they do start to appeal to those kind of brands, I think it would work out okay. But, you know, my biggest complaint, and as I mentioned to you in email, is that they only launched it in the States, which kind of makes me sad.
Well, obviously they're going to expand that. They're starting in the U.S. Now, I mean, just sort of to draw a picture in terms of what they're really going to be doing with this. What we're talking about are fade-in and fade-out text links played during the video that you're watching. So let's say you're watching a YouTube video that someone made, and during the video, they're drinking a Diet Coke. Well, a fade-in, fade-out text link to Diet Coke's website might fade in and fade out during that portion of the video. It's relevant. It's not a shake-the-screen type ad. Is that going to annoy you?
I don't know. you know, it's kind of a wait and see thing. I think it might detract from the content of whatever video I'm watching. I think it might be kind of a nuisance. Could you imagine turning on your TV and seeing the same kind of things appear at the bottom of the screen? You know, you're watching Friends and they hold up a Diet Coke. So, you know, this banner at the bottom starts, you know, like scrolling across saying, buy Diet Coke today at your nearest Loblaws for $1.99 for 2 liters or something. You know,
yeah,
I don't want to see that. Like,
that would be pretty annoying.
Especially if it was on every TV show that you watched or every video that you watched. After a while, you'd just want a way to turn that feature off.
Right. So would you be happier if they went to a pre-roll or post-roll format where there was a five-second ad before or after the video? Would that be better?
I'm probably the wrong person to talk to about it. Right. Because I'd be annoyed with pretty much anything that they're going to do to my, let's say, especially if I'm creating the content. I don't want them to add anything to my content. And I guess it's going to become one of those things where if you don't want that advertising on your video, then you got to go find somewhere else to host it. And I think that's going to become, depending on how much it annoys users, I think there's going to be a mass exodus of YouTube users because, you know, if I'm working very hard on a video, I don't want them to add their advertisements to it, no matter how relevant they are to what I'm talking about.
Because it's going to sort of ruin the creative and what you're going after, and you just don't want anything to interrupt it or get in the way, right?
Yeah, I want my free video hosting.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess, look, if there's any player that's going to test this out and at least try and get it right, it's going to be Google. So it'll be interesting, you're right, it's going to be interesting to see how they make out on that and what the reaction's going to be from people. Anyway, next talking point, music. You know, it's unbelievable to see the trajectory of the music business and how much change has happened over the last however many years, but certainly we're seeing a lot of change. And, you know, DRM was a big deal. Everybody was lacing their music downloads with digital rights management stuff, and now what we're starting to see is big music players start to shift away from DRM. David, DRM-free music, are you surprised that DRM basically didn't work? I mean, is it safe to say that at this point, that DRM is a failure?
I think we actually highlighted some of this stuff before in a previous episode that, you know, DRM is just bad. You know, I can understand why the music industry wanted this kind of technology, but you're really selling to users here, and users are eventually going to decide, and that's exactly what's happened. Some of the most successful tracks on iTunes are the DRM-free tracks, and that's not going to change. So, yes, DRM is definitely dead. I'm sure one company is going to spend a whole bunch more money on trying to come up with some new fancy way to bring it back, but I, for one, won't be buying whatever they're trying to hawk on us.
Interesting. And, you know, to take this point one step further, you know, one of the bigger bands out there, Radiohead, recently made an announcement saying that their new album that's coming out, they're going to offer direct from their website. It's actually the only place I think you're going to be able to get it. You won't be able to get it on iTunes. They're going to be selling direct to their fans, and they're not going to put a price on the album. The fans are going to put a price on the album. In other words, you're going to pay what you want for their music. David, this is really revolutionary, right? I mean, we haven't really seen this before. A band going direct to consumer, basically saying to the consumers, you set the price. Is this the future? I mean, are we going to see basically bands go direct to their... I mean, is this the end of labels?
No, because labels are going to buy their high-priced lawyers and go after all these bands. They're not going to let this spread too far unless, you know... unless these bands are all going to go independent and then they're going to have distribution problems. The only reason that this worked very well for Radiohead is just because they have that brand name recognition. They, you know, people like their music. They're still fairly popular, the whole nine yards. If you took a band from a couple of years ago that isn't as popular as Radiohead and try to do something along those lines, it would only be interesting if they were first, because after this, they're not going to get the same kind of press play that Radiohead's been getting, and they're going to be struggling for sales, because they're not going to have any group back them, and they're not going to have a system like iTunes to really kind of set their price and put it on the marketplace.
But haven't we kind of seen a change in how bands can become popular? We kind of used to think, okay, you know, you got airplay on the radio and then you got signed by a label, or you say the other way around, you got signed by a label, then you got some airplay, and then you got some mass appeal, and then off you go, your CD's on store shelves. But are we kind of seeing now where, you know, bands with their MySpace pages and YouTube videos, I mean, can't bands essentially make themselves popular today? I mean, aren't bands really just a few clicks away from a mass audience? I mean, what do you think? Can bands get themselves to the point where they are maybe not Radiohead, but where they can literally start to profit off of their music direct to consumer, and then maybe it's not a spike trajectory the way it used to be, where, you know, a label picked you up and then boom, you were a star, but maybe it's a bit of a slower up curve, but maybe it's a more organic curve, and maybe it's a more sustainable curve, and maybe it's a curve that's ultimately going to be more profitable for the bands themselves, because obviously they don't give away a whole bunch of their profits to a big label. Is that possible? Or
I think not like, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, but that kind of wishful thinking on your part, it's going to come down then to, you know, who can market themselves online the best, and that's really a bad way to go. I would hate to see some of the best musicians out there not get signed by a major label and get that kind of promotion behind them, because, you know, I've worked for 2 years online, and I know how hard it can be to get your name out there.
Sure.
You know, no matter how great of a talent that you are, if you don't have the skills to promote yourself, then you get faded in the background. That would be very, very sad for some of the bands out there, because maybe they don't have the skills, but maybe they play really great music. You know, if they're not found by the mass audience or not marketed in such a way online that they're found by, let's say, like the Dig front page or something, you know, then they're forever stuck in the background and they don't get that growth curve and they don't get those sales.
But I'm wondering today what the sort of level of connection is between, you know, hot selling music and a groundswell of sort of grassroots online support for your band and your music. I'm wondering how strong is that connection? So I guess, is it becoming a precursor for real big mass popularity to have that groundswell of popularity that starts at the very base level on the web, where you've got your hardcore fans that are posting on your blog and posting in your MySpace? And do you need that today? Is that a must-have? And if it is, then bands essentially can start that on their own. And if they can start it on their own, why can't they finish it on their own? That's why I'm thinking, you know, I realize, you know, you think, well, labels still have a role, but I'm wondering if this is just sort of the beginning of the end for labels.
Well, I'm not saying that it's a label necessarily that has to really have a role in this anymore. What I'm saying is more that it's going to come down to who has the best marketer. Bands are going to not worry about labels necessarily anymore, but they're going to worry about, one, they're going to have a marketplace.
Right.
And two, they're going to have the best online or offline marketer ever, or else they're not going to get hurt.
Right.
So it's not going to be necessarily so much for the label. You're right about that. You know,
but
Sony
really,
Music or whatever, they're going to fade away, or they're going to become a PR company for all these little micro bands, you know, helping them build their MySpace pages, helping them build that community. And that's where the expertise is going to come into play.
I don't disagree with you. I guess what I disagree with is that the labels, the traditional labels of today, are going to be that sort of marketing arm online for these bands, because remember, these traditional labels are banding together and suing fans right now. So, you know, they're not exactly who you'd point to say, okay, you know, you're the experts, now market us online. So I'm wondering, okay, our definition of labels going to change?
Yes.
And yeah, there's going to be new labels, but they're going to be maybe internet marketing companies.
Yeah,
and
that's exactly the shift that I see happening. They're going to come to a point where they're going to realize, just like TV companies are realizing now, that there's this whole other world that they don't understand, and they're basically going to have to start their company over from scratch.
Right.
So you'll still see Sony Music, whatever, promoting bands, but they won't necessarily be a label anymore. They'll be their marketing campaign company. You know, they'll be their press agents. They'll be their, you know, they'll be online helping them build communities. And that is really going to have to happen soon, or else they're going to be left behind. And you're right. New names are going to pop up. You know, internet marketers are going to go, oh, shoot, you know, this band is really good. I could make them a lot of money, and in doing so, make myself some too. And you'll probably see a whole bunch of independent marketers pop up, creating their own, you know, quasi-label type things. So
companies that have online, that have the credibility, that know how to wield, you know, the social networks and know how to work that system, those are the new labels. And we don't know who those companies are yet, but chances are they're not the traditional labels that we know today, right?
Unless they realize, yeah, unless traditional labels, you know, grow up and get with the times.
Well, but they are running in another direction right now, would you agree?
They're hiding under their rock going, I don't want to change.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, Bell Canada, they have a music store, Simpatico music store, and it was all DRM-laced stuff, and they recently came out with an announcement that they're going DRM-free and going to be offering DRM-free music. So, you know, this is definitely gaining steam. You know, at the end of the day, and you're right, we did talk about this on our last podcast, but, you know, it just seems to me that, you know, the user ultimately is going to continue to gain control over their media experience. And any business model, I mean, any business model going forward, you've got to ask yourself the question, can my business succeed if the user has all of the control? And if you can answer yes to that question, then I think you're in a really good position going forward. If your answer is no, then I think you got to do a rethink, because at the end of the day, the consumer is going to have control over the entire media digestion process. And we've got to be able, or as a business, you got to be able to exist in that climate, and you got to be able to make money in that climate. And if you can't, you got problems. Do you agree?
Do you have any examples, though, of companies that have been able to master that issue, like with online video or with audio or any of those kind of mediums? Like, who's been able to do it good so far?
I guess in music, for example, I think of a website called Amy Street, A-M-I-E Street. And this is a music website that, it's been talked about a little bit, but this is a website that's taken a completely different approach to pricing music, where they basically say, okay, all songs in our store start free. And then as songs get downloaded and become more and more popular, the price begins to rise. To me, this seems like a really logical system to make work online and with digital music, because you're basically saying, you know, the popular music is priced more, the less popular music is priced less, so that works. And then, of course, there's incentive for being in early. You know, if you're an early adopter, you get it cheaper, you know, and you discover it earlier. You know, to me, that seems like a really interesting system. And I don't know if Amy Street's making a pile of money or not. It's predominantly all independent music, so I don't know exactly what their bottom line is. But I would think that kind of model is the kind of thing we're going to see in music. So maybe that doesn't entirely answer your question, but...
No, it does. And actually, it's funny because you bring up, like I mentioned before, you know, there has to be that marketplace. And if Radiohead had gone over there and put their disc on there and said, you know, well, don't necessarily continue to rise the price, let's say, past this point.
Right.
I think it would have been really interesting to see how fast it would have made it to that upper level of what they want to sell their album at.
Well, you know, this brings us to the end of TechNut Podcast number 11. David, so good to be back. I love doing this with you, and certainly, hopefully, I mean, we've talked about this before, we're going to hopefully get into a serious groove with this, and number 12 won't be too far behind. David, anything you'd like to finish off with? What's going on in your life? Any major projects that you're working on you want to talk about?
Yeah, just really quickly, I wanted to hit up the readers and let them know that I'm now working on a new blog, which not only chronicles my experiences over the last 2 years as a pro blogger, but also gives some tips and tricks from other bloggers and make money online bloggers that I'm interested in.
What's the URL for that?
Yeah, you can find that over at xfep.com. It's only 4 little letters, and it stands for Extra for Every Publisher.
And I've been there, and it's an awesome blog. And it's, yeah, for anybody who's interested in blogging, period, there's information on that blog for you to learn from. So, yeah, that's awesome.
And what about you? You must have been keeping busy this last little while.
A really neat anniversary is coming next month. Next month, video.ca is going to serve its 2 millionth video view in its 10th month of operation.
Oh,
and yeah, and really, a lot of that has happened over the last 6 months. We've seen some serious up curve in traffic and video views. And so, yeah, that's a neat little milestone. 2 million video views on video.ca in 10 months. So, yeah, good stuff. I'm really, really excited. Thanks, David. I'm really, really excited. So that's it for TechNut Podcast number 11. Thanks to our listeners for downloading. And for David Peralti, I'm James Cogan. And until next time, we are off.